Maranatha. In the name of God, the merciful and compassionate. Praise be to God, the Lord of the worlds, the merciful and compassionate, the Prince of the Day of Judgment. Thee we serve, and to Thee we pray for help. Lead us in the right way, the way of those to whom Thou hast shown mercy, upon whom no wrath resteth, and who go not astray. He looked over his right shoulder, then his left, to greet the two recording angels who wrote down his good and bad acts. When he looked over his left shoulder, he saw Abdullah. Without interrupting his prayer, the thief smiled broadly, showing his steel tooth. Wolf got up and went out. He stopped outside to put on his sandals, and Abdullah came waddling after him. They shook hands.
"You are a devout man like myself," Abdullah said. "I knew you would come sooner or later to your father's mosque." "You've been looking for me?" "Many people are looking for you."
Together they walked away from the mosque. Abdullah said,
"Knowing you to be a true believer, I could not betray you to the British, even for so large a sum of money. So I told Major Van Damme that I knew nobody by the name of Alex Wolf or Ahmed Ramha."
Wolf stopped abruptly. So they were still hunting him. He had started to feel safe too soon. He took Abdullah by the arm and steered him into an Arab cafe. They sat down. Wolf said,
"He knows my Arab name." "He knows all about you, except where to find you."
Wolf felt worried, and at the same time intensely curious.
"What's this major like?"
he asked. Abdullah shrugged.
"An Englishman, no subtlety, no manners, khaki shorts, and a face the color of a tomato."
"You can do better than that." Abdullah nodded.
"This man is patient and determined. If I were you, I should be afraid of him."
Suddenly, Wolf was afraid. He said, "What has he been doing?"
"He has found out all about your family. He has talked to all your brothers. They said they knew nothing of you."
The cafe proprietor brought each of them a dish of mashed fava beans and a flat loaf of coarse bread. Wolf broke his bread and dipped it into the beans. Flies began to gather around the bowls. Both men ignored them. Abdullah spoke through a mouthful of food.
"Van Damme is offering £100 for your address." "Ha! As if we would betray one of our own for money."
Wolf swallowed.
"Even if you knew my address."
Abdullah shrugged.
"It would be a small thing to find out."
"I know," Wolf said. "So I'm going to tell you, as a sign of my faith in your friendship, I'm living at Shepherd's Hotel." Abdullah looked hurt.
"My friend, I know this is not true. It is the first place the British would look."
"You misunderstand me," Wolf smiled. "I am not a guest there. I work in the kitchens cleaning pots, and at the end of the day I lie down on the floor with a dozen or so others and sleep there."
"So cunning!"
Abdullah grinned. He was pleased with the idea and delighted to have the information.
"You hide under their very noses."
"I know you will keep this secret," Wolf said. "And as a sign of my gratitude for your friendship, I hope you will accept from me a gift of £100.
"But this is not necessary."
"I insist." Abdullah sighed and gave in reluctantly.
"Very well.
I will have the money sent to your house." Abdullah wiped his empty bowl with the last of his bread.
"I must leave you now," he said. "Allow me to pay for your breakfast."
"Thank you."
"Ah, but I have come with no money. 1,000 pardons.
"It's nothing," Wolf said. "Allah Allah, in God's care." Abdullah replied conventionally,
"Allah Yisalimak, may God protect thee."
He went out. Wolf called for coffee and thought about Abdullah. The thief would betray Wolf for a lot less than £100, of course. What had stopped him so far was that he did not know Wolf's address. He was actively trying to discover it. That was why he had come to the mosque. Now he would attempt to check on the story about living in the kitchens of shepherds. This might not be easy, for of course no one would admit that staff slept on the kitchen floor. Indeed, Wolf was not at all sure it was true. but he had to reckon on Abdullah discovering the lie sooner or later. The story was no more than a delaying tactic. So was the bribe. However, when at last Abdullah found out that Wolf was living on Sonia's houseboat, he would probably come to Wolf for more money instead of going to Van Damme. The situation was under control, for the moment. Wolf left a few mi yem on the table and went out.
This ends side two of cassette three of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette four. Rebecca, cassette four.
The city had come to life. The streets were already jammed with traffic, the pavements crowded with vendors and beggars, the air full of good and bad smells. Wolf made his way to the central post office to use a telephone. He called GHQ and asked for Major Smith.
"We have 17 of them," the operator told him. "Have you got a first name?"
"Sandy."
"That will be Major Alexander Smith. He's not here at the moment. May I take a message?"
Wolf had known the Major would not be at GHQ. It was too early.
"The message is 12 noon today at Zamalek. Would you sign it S? Have you got that?"
"Yes, but if I may have your full..."
Wolf hung up. He left the post office and headed for Zamalek. Since Sonia had seduced Smith, the Major had sent her a dozen roses, a box of chocolates, a love letter, and two hand-delivered messages asking for another date. Wolf had forbidden her to reply. By now, Smith was wondering whether he would ever see her again. Wolf was quite sure that Sonia was the first beautiful woman Smith had ever slept with. After a couple of days of suspense, Smith would be desperate to see her again, and would jump at any chance. On the way home, Wolf bought a newspaper, but it was full of the usual rubbish. When he got to the houseboat, Sonia was still asleep. He threw the rolled-up newspaper at her to wake her. She groaned and turned over. Wolf left her and went through the curtains back into the living room. At the far end, in the prow of the boat, was a tiny open kitchen. It had one quite large cupboard for brooms and cleaning materials. Wolf opened the cupboard door. He could just about get inside it if he bent his knees and ducked his head. The catch of the door could be worked only from the outside. He searched through the kitchen drawers and found a knife with a pliable blade. He thought he could probably work the catch from inside the cupboard by sticking the knife through the crack of the door and easing it against the spring-loaded bolt. He got into the cupboard, closed the door, and tried it. It worked. However, he could not see through the door jamb. He took a nail and a flat iron and banged the nail through the thin wood of the door at eye level. He used a kitchen fork to enlarge the hole. He got inside the cupboard again and closed the door. He put his eye to the hole. He saw the curtains part, and Sonia came into the living room. She looked around, surprised that he was not there. She shrugged, then lifted her nightdress and scratched her belly. Wolf suppressed a laugh. She came across to the kitchen, picked up the kettle, and turned on the tap. Wolf slipped the knife into the crack of the door and worked the catch. He opened the door, stepped out, and said, "Good morning." Sonia screamed. Wolf laughed. She threw the kettle at him, and he dodged. He said, "It's a good hiding place, isn't it?" "You terrified me, you bastard," she said. He picked up the kettle and handed it to her. "Make the coffee," he told her. He put the knife in the cupboard, closed the door, and went to sit down. Sonia said, "What do you need a hiding place for?"
"To watch you and Major Smith. It's very funny. He looks like a passionate turtle."
"When is he coming?"
12 noon today."
"Oh, no. Why so early in the morning?"
"Listen. If he's got anything worthwhile in that briefcase, then he certainly isn't allowed to go wandering around the city with it in his hand. He should take it straight to his office and lock it in the safe. We mustn't give him time to do that. The whole thing is useless unless he brings his case here."
What we want is for him to come rushing here straight from GHQ. In fact, if he gets here late and without his briefcase, we're going to lock up and pretend you're out. Then, next time he'll know he has to get here fast. You've got it all worked out, haven't you? Wolf laughed. You'd better start getting ready. I want you to look irresistible. I'm always irresistible. She went through to the bedroom. He called after her, Wash your hair! There was no reply. He looked at his watch. Time was running out. He went around the houseboat, hiding traces of his own occupation, putting away his shoes, his razor, his toothbrush, and his fez. Sonia went up on deck in a robe to dry her hair in the sun. Wolf made the coffee and took her a cup. He drank his own, then washed his cup and put it away. He took out a bottle of champagne, put it in a bucket of ice, and placed it beside the bed with two glasses. He thought of changing the sheets, then decided to do it after Smith's visit, not before. Sonia came down from the deck. She dabbed perfume on her thighs and between her breasts. Wolf took a last look around. All was ready. He sat on a divan by a porthole to watch the towpath. It was a few minutes after noon when Major Smith appeared. He was hurrying, as if afraid to be late. He wore his uniform shirt, khaki shorts, socks, and sandals, but he had taken off his officer's cap. He was sweating in the midday sun. He was carrying his briefcase. Wolf grinned with satisfaction. Here he comes, Wolf called. Are you ready?
No.
She was trying to rattle him. She would be ready. He got into the cupboard, closed the door, and put his eye to the peephole. He heard Smith's footsteps on the gangplank, and then on the deck. The major called, Hello? Sonia did not reply. Looking through the peephole, Wolf saw Smith come down the stairs into the interior of the boat.
Is anybody there?
Smith looked at the curtains which divided off the bedroom. His voice was full of the expectation of disappointment.
Sonia?
The curtains parted. Sonia stood there, her arms lifted to hold the curtains apart. She had put her hair up in a complex pyramid, as she did for her act. She wore the baggy trousers of filmy gauze, but at this distance her body was visible through the material. From the waist up she was naked, except for a jeweled collar around her neck. Her brown breasts were full and round. She had put lipstick on her nipples. Wolf thought, Good girl. Major Smith stared at her. He was quite bowled over. He said, Oh dear, oh good Lord, oh my soul. Wolf tried not to laugh. Smith dropped his briefcase and went to her. As he embraced her, she stepped back and closed the curtains behind his back. Wolf opened the cupboard door and stepped out. The briefcase lay on the floor just this side of the curtains. Wolf knelt down, hitching up his galabiyah, and turned the case over. He tried the catches. The case was locked. Wolf whispered, Lieber Gott! He looked around. He needed a pin, a paper clip, a sewing needle, something with which to pick the locks. Moving quietly, he went to the kitchen area and carefully pulled open a drawer. Meat skewer, too thick. Bristle from a wire brush, too thin. Vegetable knife, too broad. In a little dish beside the sink, he found one of Sonia's hair clips. He went back to the case and poked the end of the clip into the keyhole of one of the locks. He twisted and turned it experimentally, encountered a kind of springy resistance, and pressed harder. The clip broke. Again Wolf cursed under his breath. He glanced reflexively at his wristwatch. Last time Smith had screwed Sonia in about 5 minutes. I should have told her to make it last, Wolf thought. He picked up the flexible knife he had been using to open the cupboard door from the inside. Gently, he slid it into one of the catches on the briefcase. When he pressed, the knife bent. He could have broken the locks in a few seconds, but he did not want to, for then Smith would know that his case had been opened. Wolf was not afraid of Smith, but he wanted the major to remain oblivious to the real reason for the seduction. If there was valuable material in the case, Wolf wanted to open it regularly. But if he could not open the case, Smith would always be useless. What would happen if he broke the locks? Smith would finish with Sonia, put on his pants, pick up his case, and realize it had been opened. He would accuse Sonia. The houseboat would be blown unless Wolf killed Smith. What would be the consequences of killing Smith? Another British soldier murdered, this time in Cairo. There would be a terrific manhunt. Would they be able to connect the killing with Wolf? Had Smith told anyone about Sonia? Who had seen them together in the Cha-Cha Club? Would inquiries lead the British to the houseboat? It would be risky, but the worst of it would be that Wolf would be without a source of information, back at square one. Meanwhile, his people were fighting a war out there in the desert, and they needed information. Wolf stood silent in the middle of the living room, racking his brains. He had thought of something back there, which gave him his answer, and now it had slipped his mind. On the other side of the curtain, Smith was muttering and groaning. Wolf wondered if he had his pants off yet. His pants off. That was it. He would have the key to his briefcase in his pocket. Wolf peeped between the curtains. Smith and Sonia lay on the bed. She was on her back, eyes closed. He lay beside her, propped up on one elbow, touching her. She was arching her back, as if she were enjoying it. As Wolf watched, Smith rolled over, half lying on her, and put his face to her breasts. Smith still had his shorts on. Wolf put his head through the curtains and waved an arm, trying to attract Sonia's attention. He thought, "Look at me, woman." Smith moved his head from one breast to the other. Sonia opened her eyes, glanced at the top of Smith's head, stroked his brigantined hair, and caught Wolf's eye. He mouthed, "Take off his pants." She frowned, not understanding. Wolf stepped through the curtains and mimed removing pants. Sonia's face cleared as enlightenment dawned. Wolf stepped back through the curtains and closed them silently, leaving only a tiny gap to look through. He saw Sonia's hands go to Smith's shorts and begin to struggle with the buttons of the fly. Smith groaned. Sonia rolled her eyes upward, contemptuous of his credulous passion. Wolf thought, "I hope she has the sense to throw the shorts this way." After a minute, Smith grew impatient with her fumbling, rolled over, sat up, and took them off himself. He dropped them over the end of the bed and turned back to Sonia. The end of the bed was about 5 feet away from the curtain. Wolf got down on the floor and lay flat on his belly. He parted the curtains with his hands and inched his way through, Indian fashion. He heard Smith say, "Oh, God, you're so beautiful." Wolf reached the shorts. With one hand, he carefully turned the material over until he saw a pocket. He put his hand in the pocket and felt for a key. The pocket was empty. There was the sound of movement from the bed. Smith grunted. Sonia said, "No, lie still." Wolf thought, "Good girl." He turned the shorts over until he found the other pocket. He felt in it. That, too, was empty. There might be more pockets. Wolf grew reckless. He felt the garment, searching for hard lumps that might be metal. There were none. He picked up the shorts. A bunch of keys lay beneath them. Wolf breathed a silent sigh of relief. The keys must have slipped out of the pocket when Smith dropped the shorts on the floor. Wolf picked up the keys and the shorts and began to inch backward through the curtains. Then he heard footsteps on deck. Smith said, "Good God, what's that?" in a high-pitched voice. "Hush," Sonia said. "Only the postman. Tell me if you like this." "Oh, yes." Wolf made it through the curtains and looked up. The postman was placing a letter on the top step of the stairs by the hatch. To Wolf's horror, the postman saw him and called out, "Sabel Kerr, good morning." Wolf put a finger to his lips for silence, then lay his cheek against his hand to mime sleep, then pointed to the bedroom. "Your pardon," the postman whispered. Wolf waved him away. There was no sound from the bedroom. Had the postman's greeting made Smith suspicious? Probably not, Wolf decided. A postman might well call good morning even if he could see no one, for the fact that the hatch was open indicated that someone was at home. The lovemaking noises in the next room resumed, and Wolf breathed more easily. He sorted through the keys, found the smallest, and tried it in the locks of the case.
It worked. He opened the other catch and lifted the lid. Inside was a sheaf of papers in a stiff cardboard folder. Wolf thought, no more menus, please. He opened the folder and looked at the top sheet. He read, Operation Aberdeen. 1. Allied forces will mount a major counterattack at dawn on June 5th. 2. The attack will be two-pronged. Wolf looked up from the papers. My God, he whispered. This is it. He listened. The noises from the bedroom were louder now. He could hear the springs of the bed, and he thought the boat itself was beginning to rock slightly. There was not much time. The report in Smith's possession was detailed. Wolf was not sure exactly how the British chain of command worked, but presumably the battles were planned in detail by General Ritchie at Desert Headquarters, then sent to GHQ in Cairo for approval by Auchinleck. Plans for more important battles would be discussed at the morning conferences, which Smith obviously attended in some capacity. Wolf wondered again which department it was that was housed in the unmarked building in the Shari Suleiman Pasha, to which Smith returned each afternoon. Then he pushed the thought aside. He needed to make notes. He hunted around for pencil and paper, thinking, I should have done this beforehand. He found a writing pad and a red pencil in a drawer. He sat down by the briefcase and read on. The main Allied forces were besieged in an area they called the Cauldron. The June 5th counterattack was intended to be a breakout. It would begin at 0520 with a bombardment by four regiments of artillery of the Aslog Ridge on Rommel's eastern flank. The artillery was to soften up the opposition in readiness for the spearhead attack by the infantry of the 10th Indian Brigade. When the Italians had breached the line at Aslog Ridge, the tanks of the 22nd Armored Brigade would rush through the gap and capture Sidi Mufta, while the 9th Indian Brigade followed through and consolidated. Meanwhile, the 32nd Army Tank Brigade, with infantry support, would attack Rommel's northern flank at Sidra Ridge. When it came to the end of the report, Wolf realized he had been so absorbed that he had heard, but not taken notice of, the sound of Major Smith reaching his climax. Now the bed creaked and a pair of feet hit the floor. Wolf tensed. Sonia said, Darling, pour some champagne. Just a minute. I want it now. I feel a bit silly with me pants off, my dear. Wolf thought, Christ, he wants his pants. Sonia said, I like you undressed. Drink a glass with me before you put your clothes on. Your wish is my command. Wolf relaxed. She may bitch about it, he thought, but she does what I want. He looked quickly through the rest of the papers, determined that he would not be caught now. Smith was a wonderful find, and it would be a tragedy to kill the goose the first time it laid a golden egg. He noted it would employ 400 tanks, 330 of them with the eastern prong, and only 70 with the northern. That Generals Messervy and Briggs were to establish a combined headquarters, and that Auchinleck was demanding, a little peevishly it seemed, thorough reconnaissance and close cooperation between infantry and tanks. A cork popped loudly as he was writing. He licked his lips, thinking, I could use some of that. He wondered how quickly Smith could drink a glass of champagne. He decided to take no chances. He put the papers back in the folder and the folder back in the case. He closed the lid and keyed the locks. He put the bunch of keys in a pocket of the shorts. He stood up and peeped through the curtain. Smith was sitting up in bed in his army-issue underwear, with a glass in one hand and a cigarette in the other, looking pleased with himself. The cigarettes must have been in his shirt pocket. It would have been awkward if they had been in his shorts. At the moment, Wolf was within Smith's field of view. He took his face away from the tiny gap between the curtains and waited. He heard Sonia say, Pour me some more, please. He looked through again. Smith took his glass and turned away to the bottle. His back was now to Wolf. Wolf pushed the shorts through the curtains and put them on the floor. Sonia saw him and raised her eyebrows in alarm. Wolf withdrew his arm. Smith handed Sonia the glass. Wolf got into the cupboard, closed the door, and eased himself to the floor. He wondered how long he would have to wait before Smith left. He did not care. He was jubilant. He had struck gold. It was half an hour before he saw, through the peephole, Smith come into the living room wearing his clothes again. By this time, Wolf was feeling very cramped. Sonia followed Smith, saying, "Must you go so soon?" "I'm afraid so," he said. "It's a very awkward time for me, you see." He hesitated. "To be perfectly frank, I'm not actually supposed to carry this briefcase around with me. I had the very devil of a job to come here at noon. You see, I have to go from GHQ straight to my office. Well, I didn't do that today. I was desperately afraid I might miss you if I came late. I told my office I was lunching at GHQ and told the chaps at GHQ I was lunching at my office. However, next time I'll go to my office, dump the briefcase, and come on here, if that's all right with you, my little puppet." Wolf thought, "For God's sake, Sonia, say something." She said, "Oh, but Sandy, my housekeeper, comes every afternoon to clean. We wouldn't be alone." Smith frowned. "Damn. Well, we'll just have to meet in the evenings." "But I have to work. And after my act, I have to stay in the club and talk to the customers. And I couldn't sit at your table every night. People would gossip." The cupboard was very hot and stuffy. Wolf was perspiring heavily. Smith said, "Can't you tell your cleaner not to come?" "But, darling, I couldn't clean the place myself. I wouldn't know how." Wolf saw her smile. Then she took Smith's hand and placed it between her legs. "Oh, Sandy, say you'll come at noon." It was much more than Smith could withstand. "Of course I will, my darling," he said. They kissed, and at last Smith left. Wolf listened to the footsteps crossing the deck and descending the gangplank. Then he got out of the cupboard. Sonia watched with malicious glee as he stretched his aching limbs. "Sore?" she said with mock sympathy. "It was worth it," Wolf said. "You were wonderful. Did you get what you wanted?" "Better than I could have dreamed." Wolf cut up bread and sausage for lunch while Sonia took a bath. After lunch, he found the English novel and the key to the code and drafted his signal to Rommel. Sonia went to the racetrack with a crowd of Egyptian friends. Wolf gave her £50 to bet with. In the evening, she went to the Cha-Cha Club, and Wolf sat at home drinking whiskey and reading Arab poetry. As midnight approached, he set up the radio. At exactly 2400 hours, he tapped out his call sign, Sphinx. A few seconds later, Rommel's Desert Listening Post, or Horch Company, answered. Wolf sent a series of V's to enable them to tune in exactly, then asked them what his signal strength was. In the middle of the sentence, he made a mistake and sent a series of E's for error before beginning again. They told him his signal was maximum strength and made GA for go ahead. He made a KA to indicate the beginning of his message. Then, in code, he began Operation Aberdeen. At the end, he added AR for message finished and K for over. They replied with a series of R's, which meant, "Your message has been received and understood." Wolf packed away the radio, the book, and the key. Then he poured himself another drink. All in all, he thought he had done incredibly well. Chapter 10. The signal from the spy was only one of 20 or 30 reports on the desk of von Malenthin, Rommel's IC, intelligence officer, at 7 o'clock on the morning of June 4th. There were several other reports from listening units. Infantry had been heard talking to tanks Eau Claire. Field headquarters had issued instructions in low-grade codes, which had been deciphered overnight. And there was other enemy radio traffic, which, although indecipherable, nevertheless yielded hints about enemy intentions simply because of its location and frequency. As well as radio reconnaissance, there were the reports from the ICs in the field, who got information from captured weapons, the uniforms of enemy dead, interrogation of prisoners, and simply looking across the desert and seeing the people they were fighting. Then there was aerial reconnaissance.
a situation report from an order of battle expert, and a summary, just about useless, of Berlin's current assessment of Allied intentions and strength. Like all field intelligence officers, von Mellenthin despised spy reports. Based on diplomatic gossip, newspaper stories, and sheer guesswork, they were wrong at least as often as they were right, which made them effectively useless. He had to admit that this one looked different. The run-of-the-mill secret agent might report, 9th Indian Brigade have been told they will be involved in a major battle in the near future. Or, Allies planning a breakout from the cauldron in early June. Or, rumors that Auchinleck will be replaced as commander-in-chief. But there was nothing indefinite about this report. The spy, whose call sign was Sphinx, began his message, Operation Aberdeen. He gave the date of the attack, the brigades involved and their specific roles, the places they would pounce, and the tactical thinking of the planners. Von Mellenthin was not convinced, but he was interested. As the thermometer in his tent passed the 100-degree mark, he began his routine round of morning discussions. In person, by field telephone, and, rarely, by radio, he talked to the divisional ICs, the Luftwaffe liaison officer for aerial reconnaissance, the Horch company liaison man, and a few of the better brigade ICs. To all of these men, he mentioned the 9th and 10th Indian Brigades, the 22nd Armored Brigade, and the 32nd Army Tank Brigade. He told them to look out for these brigades. He also told them to watch for battle preparations in the areas from which, according to the spy, the counterthrust would come. They would also observe the enemy's observers. If the spy were right, there would be increased aerial reconnaissance by the Allies of the positions they planned to attack, namely Aslag Ridge, Sidra Ridge, and Sidi Mufta. There might be increased bombing of those positions for the purpose of softening up, although this was such a giveaway that most commanders would resist the temptation. There might be decreased bombing as a bluff, and this too could be a sign. These conversations also enabled the field ICs to update their overnight reports. When they were finished, von Mellenthin wrote his report for Rommel and took it to the command vehicle. He discussed it with the chief of staff, who then presented it to Rommel. The morning discussion was brief, for Rommel had made his major decisions and given his orders for the day during the previous evening. Besides, Rommel was not in a reflective mood in the mornings. He wanted action. He tore around the desert, going from one frontline position to another in his staff car or his Storch aircraft, giving new orders, joking with the men, and taking charge of skirmishes. And yet, although he constantly exposed himself to enemy fire, he had not been wounded since 1914. Von Mellenthin went with him today, taking the opportunity to get his own picture of the frontline situation and making his personal assessment of the ICs who were sending in his raw material. Some were overcautious, omitting all unconfirmed data, and others exaggerated in order to get extra supplies and reinforcements for their units. In the early evening, when at last the thermometer showed a fall, there were more reports and conversations. Von Mellenthin sifted the mass of detail for information relating to the counterattack predicted by Sphinx. The Ariete Armored, the Italian division occupying the Aslag Ridge, reported increased enemy air activity. Von Mellenthin asked them whether this was bombing or reconnaissance, and they said reconnaissance. Bombing had actually ceased. The Luftwaffe reported activity in no man's land, which might or might not have been an advanced party marking out an assembly point. There was a garbled radio intercept in a low-grade cipher in which the Something Indian Brigade requested urgent clarification of the morning Something orders with particular reference to the timing of Something artillery bombardment. In British tactics, von Mellenthin knew, artillery bombardment generally preceded an attack. The evidence was building. Von Mellenthin checked his card index for the 32nd Army Tank Brigade and discovered that they had recently been sighted at Rigel Ridge, a logical position from which to attack Sidra Ridge. The task of an IC was an impossible one, to forecast the enemy's moves on the basis of inadequate information. He looked at the signs. He used his intuition, and he gambled. von Malenten decided to gamble on Sphinx. At 18:30 hours, he took his report to the command vehicle. Rommel was there with his chief of staff, Colonel Bayerlein, and Kesselring. They stood around a large camp table looking at the operations map. A lieutenant sat to one side, ready to take notes. Rommel had taken his cap off, and his large, balding head appeared too big for his small body. He looked tired and thin. He suffered recurring stomach trouble, von Malenten knew, and was often unable to eat for days. His normally pudgy face had lost flesh, and his ears seemed to stick out more than usual. But his slitted dark eyes were bright with enthusiasm and the hope of victory. Von Malenten clicked his heels and formally handed over the report. Then he explained his conclusions on the map. When he had done, Kesselring said, "And all this is based on the report of a spy, you say?" "No, Field Marshal," von Malenten said firmly. "There are confirming indications." "You can find confirming indications for anything," Kesselring said. Out of the corner of his eye, von Malenten could see that Rommel was getting cross. Kesselring said, "We really can't plan battles on the basis of information from some grubby little secret agent in Cairo." Rommel said, "I'm inclined to believe this report." Von Malenten watched the two men. They were curiously balanced in terms of power. Curiously, that was, for the army, where hierarchies were normally so well defined. Kesselring was C&C South, and outranked Rommel, but Rommel did not take orders from him by some whim of Hitler's. Both men had patrons in Berlin. Kesselring, the Luftwaffe man, was Goering's favorite, and Rommel produced such good publicity that Goebbels could be relied upon to support him. Kesselring was popular with the Italians, whereas Rommel always insulted them. Ultimately, Kesselring was more powerful, for as a field marshal he had direct access to Hitler, while Rommel had to go through Jodl. But this was a card Kesselring could not afford to play too often. So the two men quarreled, and although Rommel had the last word here in the desert, back in Europe, von Malenten knew, Kesselring was maneuvering to get rid of him. Rommel turned to the map. "Let us be ready, then, for a two-pronged attack. Consider first the weaker, northern prong. Sidra Ridge is held by the 21st Panzer Division with anti-tank guns. Here in the path of the British advance is a minefield. The panzers will lure the British into the minefield and destroy them with anti-tank fire. If the spy is right, and the British throw only 70 tanks into this assault, the 21st Panzers should deal with them quickly and be free for other action later in the day." He drew a thick forefinger down across the map. "Now, consider the second prong, the main assault on our eastern flank. This is held by the Italian army. The attack is to be led by an Indian brigade. Knowing those Indians and knowing our Italians, I assume the attack will succeed. I therefore order a vigorous riposte. 1. The Italians will counterattack from the west. 2. The panzers, having repelled the other prong of the attack at Sidra Ridge, will turn about and attack the Indians from the north. 3. Tonight, our engineers will clear a gap in the minefield at Bir el-Hamad so that the 15th Panzers can make a swing to the south, emerge through the gap, and attack the British forces from the rear." Von Malenten, listening and watching, nodded appreciation. It was a typical Rommel plan involving rapid switching of forces to maximize their effect, an encircling movement, and the surprise appearance of a powerful division where it was least expected in the enemy's rear. If it all worked, the attacking Allied brigades would be surrounded, cut off, and wiped out. If it all worked. If the spy was right. Kesselring said to Rommel, "I think you could be making a big mistake." "That's your privilege," Rommel said calmly. Von Malenten did not feel calm. If it worked out badly, Berlin would soon hear about Rommel's unjustified faith in poor intelligence, and von Malenten would be blamed for supplying that intelligence. Rommel's attitude to subordinates who let him down was savage. Rommel looked at the note-taking lieutenant. "Those, then, are my orders for tomorrow." He glared defiantly at Kesselring. Von Malenten put his hands in his pockets and crossed his fingers. Von Malenten remembered that moment when, 16 days later, he and Rommel watched the sun rise over Tobruk. They stood together on the escarpment northeast of El Adem, waiting for the start of the battle. Rommel was wearing the goggles he had taken from the captured General O'Connor, the goggles which had become a kind of trademark of his. He was in top form, bright-eyed, lively, and confident. You could almost hear his brain tick as he scanned the landscape and computed how the battle might go. Von Malenten said, "The spy was right." Rommel smiled. "That's exactly what I was thinking." The Allied counterattack of June 5th had come precisely as forecast, and Rommel's defense had worked so well that it had turned into a counter-counterattack. 3 of the 4 Allied brigades involved had been wiped out, and 4 regiments of artillery had been captured. Rommel had pressed his advantage remorselessly. On June 14th, the Gazala line had been broken, and today, June 20th, they were to besiege the vital coastal garrison of Tobruk. Von Malenten shivered. It was astonishing how cold the desert could be at 5 o'clock in the morning. He watched the sky. At 5:20, the attack began. A sound like distant thunder swelled to a deafening roar as the Stukas approached. The first formation flew over, dived toward the British positions, and dropped their bombs. A great cloud of dust and smoke arose, and with that, Rommel's entire artillery forces opened fire with a simultaneous ear-splitting crash. Another wave of Stukas came over, then another. There were hundreds of bombers. Von Malenten said, "Fantastic! Kesselring really did it!" It was the wrong thing to say. Rommel snapped, "No credit to Kesselring! Today we are directing the planes ourselves." The Luftwaffe was putting on a good show, even so, Von Malenten thought. But he did not say it. Tobruk was a concentric fortress. The garrison itself was within a town, and the town was at the heart of a larger British-held area surrounded by 35-mile perimeter wire dotted with strongpoints. The Germans had to cross the wire, then penetrate the town, then take the garrison. A cloud of orange smoke arose in the middle of the battlefield. Von Malenten said, "That's a signal from the assault engineers telling the artillery to lengthen their range." Rommel nodded. "Good. We're making progress." Suddenly, Von Malenten was seized by optimism. There was booty in Tobruk. Petrol, and dynamite, and tents, and trucks. Already, more than half Rommel's motorized transport consisted of captured British vehicles. And food. Von Malenten smiled and said, "Fresh fish for dinner?" Rommel understood his train of thought. "Liver," he said. "Fried potatoes. Fresh bread. A real bed, with a feather pillow. In a house with stone walls to keep out the heat and the bugs." A runner arrived with a signal. Von Malenten took it and read it. He tried to keep the excitement out of his voice as he said, "They've cut the wire at Strongpoint 69. Group Many is attacking with the infantry of the Afrika Corps." "That's it," said Rommel. "We've opened a breach. Let's go." It was 10:30 in the morning when Lieutenant Colonel Reggie Bogg poked his head around the door of Van Damme's office and said, "Tobruk is under siege." It seemed pointless to work then. Van Damme went on mechanically, reading reports from informants, considering the case of a lazy lieutenant who was due for promotion but did not deserve it, trying to think of a fresh approach to the Alex Wolf case. But everything seemed hopelessly trivial. The news became more depressing as the day wore on. The Germans breached the perimeter wire. They bridged the anti-tank ditch. They crossed the inner minefield. They reached the strategic road junction known as King's Cross. Van Damme went home at 7 to have supper with Billy. He could not tell the boy about Tobruk. The news was not to be released at present. As they ate their lamb chops, Billy said that his English teacher, a young man with a lung condition who could not get into the army, never stopped talking about how he would love to get out into the desert and have a bash at the Hun. "I don't believe him, though," Billy said. "Do you?" "I expect he means it," Van Damme said. "He just feels guilty." Billy was at an argumentative age.
"Guilty? He can't feel guilty. It's not his fault."
"Unconsciously, he can."
"What's the difference?" I walked into that one, Van Damme thought. He considered for a moment, then said, "When you've done something wrong and you know it's wrong, and you feel bad about it, and you know why you feel bad, that's conscious guilt."
This ends side one of cassette four. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Mr. Simkison has done nothing wrong, but he still feels bad about it, and he doesn't know why he feels bad. That's unconscious guilt. It makes him feel better to talk about how much he wants to fight. "Oh," said Billy. Van Damme did not know whether the boy had understood or not. Billy went to bed with a new book. He said it was a tech, by which he meant a detective story. It was called Death on the Nile. Van Damme went back to GHQ. The news was still bad. The 21st Panzers had entered the town of Tobruk and fired from the quay onto several British ships which were trying belatedly to escape to the open sea. A number of vessels had been sunk. Van Damme thought of the men who made a ship, and the tons of precious steel that went into it, and the training of the sailors, and the welding of the crew into a team. And now the men were dead, the ship sunk, the effort wasted. He spent the night in the officer's mess, waiting for news. He drank steadily and smoked so much that he gave himself a headache. Bulletins came down periodically from the operations room. During the night, Ritchie, as commander of the 8th Army, decided to abandon the frontier and retreat to Mercer Matru. It was said that when Auchinleck, the commander-in-chief, heard this news, he stalked out of the room with a face as black as thunder. Toward dawn, Van Damme found himself thinking about his parents. Some of the ports on the south coast of England had suffered as much as London from the bombing, but his parents were a little way inland, in a village in the Dorset countryside. His father was postmaster at a small sorting office. Van Damme looked at his watch. It would be 4 in the morning in England now. The old man would be putting on his cycle clips, climbing on his bike, and riding to work in the dark. At 60 years of age, he had the constitution of a teenage farm boy. Van Damme's chapel-going mother forbade smoking, drinking, and all kinds of dissolute behavior, a term she used to encompass everything from darts matches to listening to the wireless. The regime seemed to suit her husband, but she herself was always ailing. Eventually, booze, fatigue, and tedium sent Van Damme into a doze. He dreamed he was in the garrison at Tobruk with Billy and Elena and his mother. He was running around, closing all the windows. Outside, the Germans, who had turned into firemen, were leaning ladders against the wall and climbing up. Suddenly, Van Damme's mother stopped counting her forged banknotes and opened a window, pointing at Elena and screaming, "The Scarlet Woman!" Rommel came through the window in a fireman's helmet and turned a hose on Billy. The force of the jet pushed the boy over a parapet, and he fell into the sea. Van Damme knew he was to blame, but he could not figure out what he had done wrong. He began to weep bitterly. He woke up. He was relieved to discover that he had not really been crying. The dream left him with an overwhelming sense of despair. He lit a cigarette. It tasted foul. The sun rose. Van Damme went around the mess turning out the lights just for something to do. A breakfast cook came in with a pot of coffee. As Van Damme was drinking his, a captain came down with another bulletin. He stood in the middle of the mess, waiting for silence. He said, "General Klopper surrendered the garrison of Tobruk to Rommel at dawn today." Van Damme left the mess and walked through the streets of the city toward his house by the Nile. He felt impotent and useless, sitting in Cairo catching spies, while out there in the desert his country was losing the war. It crossed his mind that Alex Wolfe might have had something to do with Rommel's latest series of victories. But he dismissed the thought as somewhat far-fetched. He felt so depressed that he wondered whether things could possibly get any worse.
and he realized that, of course, they could. When he got home, he went to bed. Part 2. Mirza Matru. Chapter 11. The Greek was a feeler. Elena did not like feelers. She did not mind straightforward lust. In fact, she was rather partial to it. What she objected to was furtive, guilty, unsolicited groping. After 2 hours in the shop, she had disliked Mikis Aristopoulos. After 2 weeks, she was ready to strangle him. The shop itself was fine. She liked the spicy smells and the rows of gaily colored boxes and cans on the shelves in the back room. The work was easy and repetitive, but the time passed quickly enough. She amazed the customers by adding up their bills in her head very rapidly. From time to time, she would buy some strange imported delicacy and take it home to try. A jar of liver paste, a Hershey bar, a bottle of Bovril, a can of baked beans. And for her, it was novel to do an ordinary, dull, 8 hours a day job. But the boss was a pain. Every chance he got, he would touch her arm, her shoulder, or her hip. Each time he passed her, behind the counter or in the back room, he would brush against her breasts or her bottom. At first she had thought it was accidental, because he did not look the type. He was in his 20s, quite good-looking, with a big smile that showed his white teeth. He must have taken her silence for acquiescence. She would have to tread on him a little. She did not need this. Her emotions were too confused already. She both liked and loathed William Van Damme, who talked to her as an equal, then treated her like a whore. She was supposed to seduce Alex Wolfe, whom she had never met, and she was being groped by Mikis Aristopoulos, for whom she felt nothing but scorn. "They all use me," she thought. "It's the story of my life." She wondered what Wolfe would be like. It was easy for Van Damme to tell her to befriend him, as if there were a button she could press which made her instantly irresistible. In reality, a lot depended on the man. Some men liked her immediately. With others, it was hard work. Sometimes it was impossible. Half of her hoped it would be impossible with Wolfe. The other half remembered that he was a spy for the Germans, and Rommel was coming closer every day, and if the Nazis ever got to Cairo... Aristopoulos brought a box of pasta out from the back room. Elena looked at her watch. It was almost time to go home. Aristopoulos dropped the box and opened it. On his way back, as he squeezed past her, he put his hands under her arms and touched her breasts. She moved away. She heard someone come into the shop. She thought, "I'll teach the Greek a lesson." As he went into the back room, she called after him loudly in Arabic, "If you touch me again, I'll cut your cock off." There was a burst of laughter from the customer. She turned and looked at him. He was a European, but he must understand Arabic, she thought. She said, "Good afternoon." He looked toward the back room and called out, "What have you been doing, Aristopoulos, you young goat?" Aristopoulos poked his head around the door. "Good day, sir. This is my niece, Elena." His face showed embarrassment and something else which Elena could not read. He ducked back into the storeroom. "Niece," said the customer, looking at Elena. "A likely tale." He was a big man, in his 30s, with dark hair, dark skin, and dark eyes. He had a large hooked nose, which might have been typically Arab or typically European aristocratic. His mouth was thin-lipped, and when he smiled he showed small, even teeth, like a cat's, Elena thought. She knew the signs of wealth, and she saw them here. A silk shirt, a gold wristwatch, tailored cotton trousers with a crocodile belt, handmade shoes and a faint masculine cologne. Elena said, "How can I help you?" He looked at her as if he were contemplating several possible answers. Then he said, "Let's start with some English marmalade." "Yes." The marmalade was in the back room. She went there to get a jar. "It's him," Aristopoulos hissed. "What are you talking about?" she asked in a normal voice. She was still mad at him. "The bad money man. Mr. Wolfe, that's him." Oh, God. For a moment she had forgotten why she was here.
Aristopoulos' panic infected her, and her mind went blank. What shall I say to him? What should I do?
I don't know. Give him the marmalade. I don't know.
Yes, the marmalade, right. She took a jar of Cooper's Oxford from a shelf and returned to the shop. She forced herself to smile brightly at Wolfe as she put the jar down on the counter. What else?
2 pounds of the dark coffee, ground fine.
He was watching her while she weighed the coffee and put it through the grinder. Suddenly she was afraid of him. He was not like Charles, Johnny, and Claude, the men who had kept her. They had been soft, easygoing, guilty, and pliable. Wolfe seemed poised and confident. It would be hard to deceive him, and impossible to thwart him, she guessed.
Something else?
A tin of ham.
She moved around the shop, finding what he wanted, and putting the goods on the counter. His eyes followed her everywhere. She thought, I must talk to him. I can't keep saying something else. I'm supposed to befriend him.
Something else? She said.
A half case of champagne.
The cardboard box containing 6 full bottles was heavy. She dragged it out of the back room.
I expect you'd like us to deliver this order, she said.
She tried to make it sound casual. She was slightly breathless with the effort of bending to drag the case, and she hoped this would cover her nervousness. He seemed to look through her with his dark eyes.
Deliver? He said.
No, thank you.
She looked at the heavy box.
I hope you live nearby.
Close enough.
You must be very strong.
Strong enough.
We have a thoroughly reliable delivery man.
No delivery,
he said firmly. She nodded. As you wish. She had not really expected it to work, but she was disappointed all the same.
Something else?
I think that's all.
She began to add up the bill. Wolfe said,
Aristopoulos must be doing well to employ an assistant.
Elena said, £5.12 and 6. You wouldn't say that if you knew what he pays me. £5.13 and 6. 6 pounds.
Don't you like the job?
She gave him a direct look. I'd do anything to get out of here.
What did you have in mind?
He was very quick. She shrugged and went back to her addition. Eventually she said, £13.10 and 4.
How did you know I'd pay in sterling?
He was quick. She was afraid she'd given herself away. She felt herself begin to blush. She had an inspiration and said,
You're a British officer, aren't you?
He laughed loudly at that. He took out a roll of pound notes and gave her 14. She gave him his change in Egyptian coins. She was thinking, What else can I do? What else can I say? She began to pack his purchases into a brown paper shopping bag. She said, Are you having a party? I love parties.
What makes you ask?
The champagne.
Ah, well, life is one long party,
she thought. I've failed. He will go away now, and perhaps he won't come back for weeks, perhaps never. I've had him in my sights. I've talked to him, and now I have to let him walk away and disappear into the city. She should have felt relieved, but instead she felt a sense of abject failure. He lifted the case of champagne onto his left shoulder and picked up the shopping bag with his right hand.
Goodbye, he said.
Goodbye.
He turned around at the door.
Meet me at the Oasis restaurant on Wednesday evening at 7:30.
All right, she said jubilantly.
But he was gone. It took them most of the morning to get to the Hill of Jesus. Jakes sat in the front next to the driver. Van Damme and Boggs sat in the back. Van Damme was exultant. An Australian company had taken the hill in the night, and they had captured almost intact a German wireless listening post. It was the first good news Van Damme had heard for months. Jakes turned around and shouted over the noise of the engine.
Apparently the Aussies charged in their socks to surprise him, he said. Most of the Italians were taken prisoner in their pajamas.
Van Damme had heard the same story.
The Germans weren't sleeping, though, he said. It was quite a rough show.
They took the main road to Alexandria, then the coast road to Al Alamein, where they turned onto a barrel track.
a route through the desert marked with barrels. Nearly all the traffic was going in the opposite direction, retreating. Nobody knew what was happening. They stopped at a supply dump to fill up with petrol, and Bog had to pull rank on the officer in charge to get a chitty. Their driver asked for directions to the hill.
"Bottle track," the officer said brusquely.
The tracks, created by and for the army, were named Bottle, Boot, Moon, and Star, the symbols for which were cut into the empty barrels and petrol cans along the routes. At night, little lights were placed in the barrels to illuminate the symbols. Bog asked the officer,
"What's happening out here? Everything seems to be heading back east."
"Nobody tells me anything," said the officer.
They got a cup of tea and a bully beef sandwich from the Nafi truck. When they moved on, they went through a recent battlefield, littered with wrecked and burned-out tanks, where a graveyard detail was desultorily collecting corpses. The barrels disappeared, but the driver picked them up again on the far side of the gravel plain. They found the hill at midday. There was a battle going on not far away. They could hear the guns and see clouds of dust rising to the west. Van Damme realized he had not been this near the fighting before. The overall impression was one of dirt, panic, and confusion. They reported to the command vehicle and were directed to the captured German radio trucks. Field intelligence men were already at work. Prisoners were being interrogated in a small tent, one at a time, while the others waited in the blazing sun. Enemy ordnance experts were examining weapons and vehicles, noting manufacturers' serial numbers. The Y service was there, looking for wavelengths and codes. It was the task of Boggs' little squad to investigate how much the Germans had been learning in advance about Allied movements. They took a truck each. Like most people in intelligence, Van Damme had a smattering of German. He knew a couple of hundred words, most of them military terms, so that while he could not have told the difference between a love letter and a laundry list, he could read army orders and reports. There was a lot of material to be examined. The captured post was a great prize for intelligence. Most of the stuff would have to be boxed, transported to Cairo,